From the Sri Satya Sai Media Center at Prashanthi Nilayam, you are listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. I am Chandu Vijay and this is Love to Love. And today we have a talk by Dr. Amey Deshpande, a resident fellow at the Sri Satya Sai Center for Human Values here in Prashanthi Nilayam. Prior to this, Amey had completed his MBA and doctorate from the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning. He was very actively involved with the dramatics team of the university during his student days and is also a member of the Prashanthi Mandir Bhajan group. The theme of this talk is Swami, our Sadguru. This talk was delivered in the Satsang Hall here in Prashanthi Nilayam on the 8th of July 2018. With that, over to Dr. Amey Deshpande.
We'll start with a bhajan, so you can all follow.
Satguru Dev, raah dikhao Prabhu. Satguru Dev, raah dikhao Prabhu. Satguru Dev, raah dikhao Prabhu. Satguru Dev, raah dikhao Sai Deva. Raah dikhao Sai Deva. Satguru Dev, raah dikhao Prabhu. O Prabhu, tum ho mere pran data, pran data, tum ho mere pran data, tum ho mere भाग्य विधाता, तुम हो मेरे भाग्य दाता, भाग्य दाता, सतगुरु देव राह दिखाओ प्रभु.
Offering our loving pranams at the lotus feet of our ever-present Swami, and offering my pranams to the Swami seated in all of you, dear brothers and sisters, revered elders, a warm and loving Sai Ram to all of you. The reason I started with this particular bhajan was because we are entering a very important phase in this year, which is very close to the Guru Purnima. One of the most auspicious occasions in Prashanthi Nilayam. So there are four major festivals in which are celebrated with a lot of significance and with a lot of fervor in Prashanthi, and that is obviously Swami's birthday, 23rd of November, Shivaratri, Guru Purnima, and Aradhana festival. For many, many years, the Guru Purnima has been a very significant event in Prashanti. A lot of very important things in the milestone of in the history of Prashanti Nilayam has happened on Guru Purnima day. And so why is Guru Purnima so important? I think it's because it is one day where we are able to worship Swami, or we have the opportunity to worship Swami as our Guru, as our Master. And why is that important? One of my friends, one of my colleagues in when I was studying in Swami's college, once he had an opportunity to ask Swami this question. He asked Swami, "Swami, what is the best relationship that we can have with you?" Isn't it an interesting question? Right? All of us want to know, what is the best relationship to have with God? And the thought in our mind usually is, the relationship between God and devotee. The God-devotee relationship is the best relationship. Probably mother and son relationship is a great relationship. But Swami's answer was very different. Swami said the best relationship that we can have with Swami is that of a master and a disciple. Guru-Shishya relationship. Guru-Shishya Bandhanam, Swami used the word. The relationship between Guru and a Shishya, a master and a disciple. And that is why, I started this little satsang with this bhajan, Sadguru Dev Rah Dikhao Prabhu, because he is fundamentally our master. And Swami went on to explain, why is it important to have, that kind of relationship between God and us as master and a disciple. Swami said, because in every other relationship, there is always a contractual agreement. For example, a mother and a child, possibly the most innocent and the purest form of relationship, but still it is because the child has come from the mother. That is why the mother has that kind of relationship. So there is a bit of a contractual relationship between the mother and a child. Between a husband and a wife, between a friend and another friend, there is always some reason for a relationship to exist. There is some give and take why the relationship exists. But Swami said that the relationship between a master and a disciple is beyond all conditions. See, often when we make any, I'm sure you must be aware of the Black Friday sale on Amazon, right? We all wait for the Amazon sale or whatever sale, right? And that is because we get tremendous discounts. But in that discount, if you notice, there will be one asterisk marks on top. And down it will be written, conditions apply. If you use this card, if you use this credit card, then you will get the discount. Right? Similarly, Swami says, in all other relationships in the world, there is always this asterisk mark on top. Okay, the asterisk mark says, conditions apply. Please read the document carefully. Right? But in a relationship between a master and a disciple, no such conditions apply. There is no reason for this love. There is no season for this love. Swami himself says, right? So why do I love my master? No reason. I don't need a reason to love my master. I don't need a season to love my master. The moment we put a reason to it, then we are trying to limit it. For example, if we say that I love Swami because, the moment this word because comes, there is the Swami on top is saying, oh, is it? Then I will remove this reason and let me see whether you still love me or not. Right? For example, I love him because he grants me whatever I ask for. Okay, I will not grant you. Then let us see whether you love me or not. Which means only because I grant you what you want, that is why you love me. What's the big deal in that? Anybody does that? Right? For example, a doctor who saves the life of a patient, for that patient, the doctor is God, because he was able to grant him health, probably longevity of life. Right? So in a sense, everything is God. So the doctor is also God. possibly a person who gives water to a very thirsty man, for that thirsty man, that water giver is God. Right? Then do we then therefore say that he is my master? The doctor, does he become my master? Does that water giver become my master? No, right? So therefore, Swami was saying that there is no conditions that apply. The master doesn't look at our qualifications while taking us as a student. If he did, none of us would be here. Yes or no? Right? Absolutely not. We have absolutely no qualifications to become his student, to become his disciple. In fact, some of these conditions are so stringent, if we were really to become a disciple, the conditions can be so stringent, you know, as Lord Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita chapter 12, an entire chapter is dedicated to whom he thinks is his devotee. We say we are Bhagavan's devotee, but Krishna in 12th chapter says, if you want to call yourself my devotee, then following conditions apply. He's giving us an asterisk mark over there on top. Conditions apply. Just one of them is sufficient to kind of take us off the list. No? Adveshta sarvabhutanam maitriya karuna evacha nirmamo nirahamkaraha samadukha sukha kshami. Finished. This is one verse of the 12th chapter. Adveshta sarvabhutanam, which means the one who does not hate anybody in this world. Advesha means no dvesha. Dvesha means hatred. Okay, sarvabhutanam, the one who does not have any hatred towards anybody in this world. I am out there only. There are so many people whom I don't like. Okay, maitriya karuna evacha means the one who has friendship, maitriya, and karuna, compassion. Probably a little easy. Nirmamo nirahamkara, no attachment, no ego. Sai Ram. Finished. We are out over there. Sama dukha sukha kshami, the one who maintains equanimity in dukha and sukha, in pain and pleasure. This is one of his conditions in chapter 12. Right? So he has given his conditions. And yet we find ourselves over here at the lotus feet of our master. Right? Which means he did not look at any qualifications while he was taking us as his disciples. Right? Now do we keep any qualifications on him when we are choosing him as our master? We can. He allows us. That is why he said, no, come, examine, experience, and then decide. You come to Prashanti, you examine Swami, you experience his divinity, then you decide whether you want this as your master or not. Right? So he gives us that one chance to examine him. Once he has passed our examination, then let us not put further tests for him. Right? Once we have decided that, yes, this is my guru, this is my God, then that is it. Right? So, in this bhajan, no, Satguru Dev Rah Dikhao Prabhu. What is this path? So, now that we have, I think we have more or less established the fact that he is our guru. Yes or no? I will leave that to you. You don't have to specifically affirm it right now. You can go and think about it, whether you want Swami as our guru or not. What does a guru do? Satguru Dev Rah Dikhao Prabhu. He shows us the path. What is the path? I'm reminded of a very beautiful story. I have told it many, many times, but how many other times I repeat it, it's still an extremely favorite story of mine. So at the cost of repetition, but at the reward of the significance of the story, I will still tell you the story. The story is an introduction to Vedanta. You know, if you look at the Sanatana Dharma, some of the greatest heroes of Vedanta philosophy have been little children. For example, if you look at all the heroes of the Upanishads, Upamanyu, Nachiketa, Shvetaketu, okay, all of these were all little children, which is what our ancestors wanted to tell us, that start early, drive slowly, reach safely. Start when you are small. Right? It is not too late. It is never too early to start on the path of spirituality. Okay? The reason I tell you this is, these stories were used to introduce the concept of Vedanta. Vedanta is supposed to be the anta of Vedas, which means the end of all Vedas, which is the crux, the kind of the butter that emerges out of the churning when you churn the Vedas. The butter that emerges is Vedanta, and which is in the form of Upanishads. So this story is how we introduce Vedanta to little children. And since we are all little children on the spiritual path, this story is very relevant to us. What is the story? There was a forest, there was a kingdom called Mayaranya. Okay, it's all in a double, you will find a parallel going on. So the kingdom is called Mayaranya, which is the forest of the Maya, which is illusion, the world proper. And there was a king and a queen, the lion and the lioness, who had just passed away giving birth to their child. Their child was a lion, a small little cub, whose name was Avinash. Since Avinash was born and his parents had passed away, the sheep in that area, the goats and the sheep in that area, they decided to raise Avinash. So while Avinash was a lion, because he grew up with all sheep and goats, all throughout his life, he believed that he was a sheep or a goat. So he would eat grass. Okay, he was not eating what comes naturally to him because he was trained to eat grass. He used to bleat, he never roared. Can you imagine a lion bleating? Okay, but he did not know how to roar because he was never taught. He was the most meek, absolutely lack of confidence, running away at the slightest, trigger of fear. And that is how so on and so forth. Of course, in size, he grew up like a lion. So just imagine, in a herd of goats and sheep, there will be one golden-maned lion, full-fledged lion, who will be behaving like a goat. One day, it so happened that the neighboring kingdom's king, his name was Purushottama. Purushottama visits Mayaranya to see what is going on. I have not heard, not much news on Google News, nothing is coming up about Mayaranya. So let me go pay a visit and find out what is happening. So he goes, he stands on the top of a cliff. He is just overseeing the entire Mayaranya kingdom. And he notices the most outrageous, most crazy event. What is that? All the sheep and the goats are grazing, and right in the middle of this big herd of sheep is a lion, which is also grazing. He's shocked. He's not able to believe his eyes. And so he wants to investigate further and starts running. So the moment he starts running towards the sheep, what do the herd do? They start absolutely running for their lives away from. And right at the front of the pack of these goats and sheep is Avinash, running away from Purushottama. And so Purushottama is even more intrigued. What is this? he should be coming for a fight. Why is he running away? And so he runs and catches hold of Avinash and says, "What are you doing? What is wrong with you? Have you forgotten?" And the only response that Avinash has is, "No, please, don't eat me. Don't let me be your breakfast or lunch." And so Purushottama says, "No, no, I have not caught you to kill you. I have caught you because you have forgotten who you are. What are you doing?" He says, "What am I doing? I am doing what everybody does. I am a goat, and so I am grazing. I have not done anything wrong in my life. I have not harmed anybody." He says, "No, you are not a goat." "What do you mean I am not a goat? All my life I have grazed, I have bleated. What are you telling me?" And so Purushottama realizes that no, this fellow will not understand like this. And so he says, "Come on, roar along with me now." And Purushottama gives the roar. And I'm sure if those of you who have heard the roar of the lion, okay, you know what it is, right? I have heard the roar of a lion. They say that it has a radius of about 5 kilometers. You can hear the lion roar at 5 kilometers radius. Okay, that is why it is called the lion's roar. Okay, and so Purushottama gives the royal roar, and Avinash is able to give only bleat mingled roars. He's bleating. He's not roaring. And so he says, what is wrong with this fellow? And so he grabs him by the neck. Purushottama grabs Avinash by the neck and takes him to a pond, a still pond where the water is absolutely still, and shoves his head on top of the lake of the pond and says, look, Avinash, look how I look and see how you look. We both look alike. And for the first time, Avinash is seeing his own image. He has never seen himself before. So all the while he's thinking that he is a goat. For the first time, he's getting introduced to a new person. Who? The person in the mirror. And what? Lo and behold, what does he see? He's seeing that this Purushottama, who is a king, looks exactly like he looks. And for the first time, Avinash is risen or is awakened to his true reality, that he is not merely a sheep, he is the lion himself. And so then it says that the story goes on, and then Purushottama says that, come on, now roar with me. Now you know who you are, isn't it? Roar along with me. And they say that Mayaranya found its king when Avinash roared for the first time. This is the story that is narrated to introduce Vedanta. What does it mean? Is all the while we think that we are ordinary, we think that we are just like a sheep or a goat, meant to be grazing, meant to be bleating, completely oblivious of our true reality, that we are actually a lion. Right? That is why if you look at even our Kulwant Hall, next to the Samadhi, what do you see? Two lions. Right? Next to Bhagwan's chair, on the throne on one side, on the lady's side, you'll find two lions. Those lions are put there to remind us who we really are. We really are of royal blood. The blood that flows in our veins, okay, is his blood which flows through our veins. We are not ordinary. We are lions. And that is the path that the Lord comes to show, that the Guru. So it is not a destination that the Guru comes to take us on, okay, but it's an inner journey that the Guru comes to take us on. Right? See, the lion was all the while a lion. Yes or no? Right? At no point of time was he a goat. But it was his thought process which made him think that he was a goat. Right? Similarly, we think that we are ordinary human beings. We think that we are mere mortals. But a guru comes and, like Purushottama, our Sadguru comes and tells us that, no, my child, you have forgotten yourself, are? So it seems, you know, once on the same theme of the lionhood, once somebody asked Swami, Swami, you say that this entire world is mithya, is maya, illusion. And you are also in this world. Which means, are you also an illusion? Interesting question, isn't it? And just imagine telling God that, God, actually you are illusion only. Huh? Okay. And Swami says, you know, in the dream, when you are so lost in your dream, in the dream world, which is an illusory world, a lion, assume a lion comes into the dream and it roars so loudly that you are awakened from that dream. Right? Many times it happens to us, isn't it? We dream and then there is a particular moment in the dream where it shakes us out of our dream. Okay? Swami is telling, I am like that lion who has come into your dream to awaken you from the dream. Okay? He is like that. So, in a sense, he is illusion only. But he is that master who has come into this world to tell us that, Are Baba, don't dream. You are not ordinary. We are not ordinary. Right? That is the path that the Guru comes to tell us. There are two words in this bhajan that we sang. One is Tumaho Mere Pran Data. And second one is Tumaho Mere Bhagya Vidhata. So let us see how Guru is actually Pranadata and Bhagyavidata. Pranadata means giver of life, and Bhagyavidata means the writer of our destinies. Right? So the Guru is the one who gives us life and who is also the writer of our destinies. Look at the case of Avinash. Was he leading a life? Yes, he was alive. Yes. But if he did not know who he truly was, is that a life? Really not a life, right? Imagine all the while we assume, or let us imagine that we all the time are stuck in first standard, primary one. We never cross primary one because we think we are never intelligent enough to pass primary one. Imagine our case. Okay, the 35-year-old guy who is sitting and still writing primary one class. Right? Is that a life? No, right? So the first thing is, the moment he shows us our identity, the moment he shows us our reality, he actually breathes life into our otherwise dreary existence. Yes, and therefore in that sense, he is a Pranadata. There is a very beautiful analogy that is you can find in Shirdi Sai Satcharita. It's a beautiful book on the life of Shirdi Sai Baba. I'm not sure how many of you have read it. It's a very short book. It's like a Parayana book. You should finish it in 1 week. In that, there's a very beautiful analogy of this guru. Himadpant, the author of Shirdi Sai Satcharita, writes that a guru is someone who is taking us as a guide across a forest. So now imagine there is a very, very dangerous forest that we have to cross. Our destination is on the other side of the forest. So you don't know how to approach this forest. There is a person who is sitting right at the edge of the forest entrance. And he comes and you go and you tell him, "Sir, is there a way through this forest?" "Yeah, yeah, there are many ways through this forest." Then the person at the entrance says, "Sir, do you know how to cross this?" "Yeah, yeah, I have gone many times through this forest." "Sir, can you show me how to go?" "Yeah, you go from here, you take the first left turn, then you take right, then after the second left turn, you take the third right." "Whoa, relax, man. You know, calm down, tell me, can you draw me on a piece of paper?" And he draws, okay, and he shows you that this is the way to get through this jungle. Instead of that, instead of such a person, imagine there is another person who says, "Hey, come to me." "Yes, sir." "You want to cross through the forest?" "Yes, sir, I want to go through the forest to the other side." "Come, I will take you. I know how to cross this forest." Which one will we choose? Obviously, the second one. Swami says that is the difference between a guru and a sadguru. Okay, a guru will show us the way, but a sadguru will take us on the way. He will hold our hand and he will actually show us the path. He will walk with us on that path. Satguru Dev, Rah Dikhao Prabhu. Right? Swami, for that matter, all the avatars and all the great masters who have walked, they will be someone who will hold our hands and take us on this path. Just imagine, here is a guru. In fact, in Satcharita it is written that when you walk along with such a guide, it becomes so much easier because he knows exactly where what is. Right? If there are some pitfalls, if there are some thorny bushes, if there are some quicksands, he knows exactly how to go because he has done it many, many times. This is his job. His job is only to take one by one person from this end to that end. He'll come back only to take this another person. Right? We have such a Sadguru, and therefore he is the giver of our life because he not only shows us the path, but he walks with us on the path. And for that, and I mean for that matter, I don't even want to go into, you know, waste too much time on telling how we can learn from Swami's life. Right? Every moment of the way, he has actually walked that path. He has actually walked and shown us how to walk.
You are listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.
Take me away, won't you carry me?
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are now continuing with the talk by Dr. Amey Deshpande on the theme, Swami, our Sadguru. This talk was delivered in the Satsang Hall here in Prashantinilayam on the 8th of July, 2018.
The second one is Bhagya Vidata, the writer of our destinies. I am reminded of a very interesting episode. One of my elder brothers in the college, he had told us. This happened in the 90s. This brother was very smart, very intelligent, and came from a very well-to-do family. In fact, a royal family. And he was studying MBA over here. He had completed his MBA, about few months to go to complete his MBA. And now, you know, this the bug of the future, you know, what should I do after MBA? So a part of his mind was telling that I'll ask Swami, right? And that's obviously the better part of your mind, which is telling you, ask Swami whatever he tells. But he said, see, if, you know, I should also have some my own options, because Swami will tell me to do something. If I don't like it, you know, then what? So he used to wonder what he can do. And so he was in a state of flux. He was in confusion. One day, he was sitting in the darshan line. Swami walks up to him and Swami says, Haan, kab khatam hota hai tumhara MBA? When is your MBA getting over? Swami, March, it will get over. Haan, what will you do after that? He says, Swami, whatever you say. So Swami said, do IFS, Indian Foreign Service. You're very smart, intelligent. You should do IFS course such that you can join the Indian Foreign Service, by which you can become a ambassador or you can hold diplomatic positions and serve the country. So he felt, Swami has given him his way. After the bhajans, you know, while he was walking out of the mandir, the thought was, but IFS is very tough to crack, you know, and it's like the pass percent or the people who are selected into IFS is like 3% of the total number of, you know, students who apply. He said, I don't think I'll crack it, you know, and the worst part about some of these examinations like IAS or IFS or IPS is that you're allowed 4 attempts, right? It takes 4 years to give 4 attempts. Okay, that is, if you're lucky, you will be giving 1 attempt every year. Okay, and there are 3 exams. In any one of the exams, if you do not clear, you are failed. Okay, and at the end of 4 years, if you have not cleared, you have nothing with you. Means you don't even have a certificate which says you attempted this examination. So, you know, so it's like, my God, can I invest or can I waste 4 years of my life? So he was kind of, no, yaar, what Swami told me to do, yaar, I don't want to do this IFS. Okay, but okay, now Swami has told what to do. A few days later, he's sitting in the darshan lines and Swami again walks up to him and says, when is your MBA getting over? So he told Swami, in March. So what will you do after this? So he says, Swami, whatever you say, you become teacher. So he thought, oh, good. That, but that day he told IFS, now he's telling teacher. Anyway, he walked out kind of a little in a better position Swami has told me to become a teacher. But as he walked out, he said, teacher, what a profession. Means IF, where is IFS? Where is teacher? Okay, should I become college teacher or school teacher? College teacher means I have to do PhD. Okay, that is also very tough. Okay, and again confusion. Oh my God, teacher. So again, the confusion continued. Few days later, he's sitting in the darshan line. Swami walks up to him. Asks him, when is your MBA completing? Swami, March. Okay, what are you going to do? Swami, whatever you say. Swami says, go do your business along with your father. Third option. Okay, by which time he's completely flabbergasted. He's completely, you know, at wit's end. Wondering, what is this? You know, I am seeking clarity from Swami and Swami is putting more and more confusion in my life. Okay. So he walked out and as he was walking back, he was thinking, oh, simply I'm... After that, no, he started sitting away from Swami. He wouldn't sit in first row. Simply Swami will walk up to me and ask me again and create more confusion. Okay, one day Swami calls him for interview with his family. And in the interview, what are you doing? Swami, MBA, what will you do after this? He said, Swami, I have no clue, Swami. You told me first day to do IFS, then another day you told me to do become a teacher, then you're telling me to join job. Swami, why are you confusing me? Okay, he only asked Swami, why are you confusing me? And Swami said, you fool, I am not confusing you. I am merely reflecting the confusion that is already there in your head. Okay, very beautiful, no? I am merely reflecting the confusion that is there in your head. To which this brother said, Swami, if you are only going to reflect what is already there within me, then why do I need you? Yes, if you are only going to amplify the confusion that already exists in my head, okay, then why do I need you? What are you there for? You are supposed to be there to give me clarity, not to amplify my own confusion. Right? Does this not happen with us? I like this story so much because I think each one of us goes through this moment. Right? We have Swami in our life, we have Him as our master, and yet we don't always get clarity. Right? And we are wondering, Swami, why are you not giving me that clarity? And in fact, as an as the particular, let us say, the culmination day when we have to take a decision is coming closer, the confusion only seems to increase. Why is that? So Swami, where is the clarity? Where is the clarity? We are asking Swami. So same thing happened with this brother. Then Swami went on to say that you lack clarity because you don't have surrender. Right? If we truly believed that whatever Swami tells me is good for me, I will simply accept it. When I told you that you should become an IFS service, you should take up IFS service, you should have simply accepted it. What did you do? You went back and analyzed it. Oh my God, it is so tough, 4 years, etc., etc., pass, fail. No. That means you did not surrender to me. You did not have faith in my words. Okay, so next time I give you another option. That time also you did not have faith and you did not have complete conviction in what I was saying. So there is confusion in your mind because there is no sense of surrender. So if we want Swami to become the writer of our destinies, then the first thing we have to do is to give our destiny into His hands. Right? He cannot, just imagine, He is trying to write our destiny and we are holding His hand. No, not like this. You actually make it like this. How stupid, isn't it? You know, there's a very beautiful saying about surrender, which is you fall into a pit. Okay, you fall into an almost bottomless pit, a deep dungeon, and you cry out for help. Okay, and then the Lord, out of His all-encompassing compassion and mercy, He comes and He picks you up. Okay, and while you had no other solution in your life, you were waiting for this hand to come. Now His hand is lifting you out of the dungeon. Somewhere halfway out of the dungeon, as you are coming out, no, suddenly you find a new sense of confidence. The confidence is coming from where? The confidence is coming from the hand which is beneath you, which is lifting you up. Okay, suddenly halfway through, now you have got confidence. You suddenly say, now Swami, don't worry. Now I can take care of myself. From here on, thank you, Lord. So thanks a lot for your, for your help. I am okay. What does He do? He'll take off His hand. You're back there. Right? When we surrender, 100% surrender, till we are out of this dungeon, we need that hand. We have no other way. There is no sudden self-found confidence. There is only one self-confidence. That is the confidence in that self. That He will take me out. Right? So unless we have that surrender, 100% surrender, He cannot write the destiny. And He is compassionate enough to give us a chance. No problem. You fall. Once again I will lift you up. Till you realize that you need only me. And who is that me? He is the indweller of our hearts. He is not somewhere outside of us. Right? The self-confidence is the confidence in the self. Okay, the one who is indwelling in our hearts. Right? Not some external. And that is the second thing that Swami told him. He said, Swami, we come to you for clarity. Why are you causing confusion? Then Swami said, what is the clarity? To whom are you coming for clarity? If you are going to come to an external agency for clarity, be sure you will not get it. Even if it is Swami himself. Because at some point of time, this external agency will not be available in that form. Yes, we are currently, aren't we in that particular phase now? Where we do not have access to that external agency. What Swami is telling is, be clear, surrender, the rest shall follow. This is a very beautiful statement, right? Swami says, be clear and the rest shall follow. You get that clarity. From where will you get that clarity? From your surrender to the one who is inside, indwelling in your heart. Napoleon. Is that Napoleon's? Be clear and the rest shall follow? Okay, I did not know that. Thank you. Yes. Swami would often tell this in his discourses, right? Be clear and the rest shall follow. What is that clarity? The clarity is our confidence in our surrender. Right? Once we are able to get that complete surrender to the one who is seated inside, not to an external agency, because any external agency is temporary. Right? He comes us to tell us that, see boss, and that is why this another very beautiful story to show how the one who is outside and the one who is inside is the same. One of our, our sirs, who was a student over here, he was narrating this very beautiful incident, something which inspires me again. Bhajans were going on one evening. In those days, the bhajans used to happen inside the bhajan hall, not outside, like how it happens now. In fact, where Bhagwan's sannidhi is right now, Swami started sitting in that place only from around 1999. In fact, from 99, he started spending more and more time over there. Okay, he would, in fact, otherwise, over there, students would sit and Swami would spend more time in the upper portico, right outside the interview room. If you know what is the interview room. Do you know what the interview room is? Yes. Yeah, right next to the bhajan hall. So Swami would come out from there and we would all be seated on the upper portico. That's where Swami would spend. From 99 onwards, Swami started spending more time. Like we started sitting where we currently sit, and Swami would stand where he currently is. And he would speak for many hours every day. And it would be general chit chat, divine chit chat, not human chit chat. And so he would stand there and ask all sorts of questions and talk. And one day, out of the blue, he suddenly said, I am preparing this place because I am going to be here forever. In 99. At that time, it did not make sense at all. And in fact, after that, up to 2007, bhajans used to happen inside the bhajan hall. Suddenly, in 2007, one fine day, suddenly Swami said, let the bhajans be outside. Okay, till then, bhajan singers used to sit inside bhajan hall. And for us, it was bad because we lost that proximity with Swami. Otherwise, we were literally in what I would call the slapping range. we would be in this range. If he wanted to slap us, he could. That close we used to sit to Swami. And now outside, he was about 10, 15 feet away. Okay, but then it so happened, how selfish, we are. I'm saying we in the sense I am. All we bhajan singers know, we did not want to give up that proximity. So we continued, even though once or twice Swami told us to sit outside and do bhajans, we would generally be, by default, we would sit inside bhajan hall. Means our default was bhajan hall. Swami had to tell us every time, go out and sing. Okay, because we did not want to give up that. So we were thinking that maybe this is a odd case. Probably once in an exceptional circumstance of having bhajans outside. One day what Swami did? He went outside and sat, and he told, bhajan boys can sing from inside only. Full bhajans, for 1 hour he sat outside while bhajans were going on inside. Okay, and he was so mad at us that day, he did not come, even Aarti he did not take inside bhajan hall. He called Pujari sir to come outside and take Aarti. While getting into the car, he looked at the bhajan hall, looked at all of us and said, selfish, very, very selfish fellows. all of us were, next day promptly we all sat outside. because he knew that you fellows, you don't want to have bhajans outside because you want to hog all the limelight. You want to hog the proximity. of course, needless to say, idiots that we did not realize that until Swami got angry the next day onwards, right? Why did Swami shift the bhajans outside? We never knew. Till 24th of April 2011, when Swami was placed over there, right? Because Swami said, I am preparing this place for the next 1,000 years. For thousands of years, that is the place where I will be seated. Right? That is the power of that sannidhi. It's not an ordinary sannidhi. The reason I am coming back to is that any external agency, as long as we depend on any external agency to show us the path, it is going to be a temporary phenomenon. A necessary, but a temporary phenomenon. We have to turn inwards. We have to turn within ourselves to seek that clarity, to get that surrender. Right? I will probably just end on this, on a couple of points. Why this surrender is such an important, or why it is the only way to get a solution. One of the possibly the pinnacle of human thought, right? The pinnacle of human thought is the Bhagavad Gita. It is said that even by people who do not believe in Lord Krishna as God, it is the greatest synthesis of human thought. Because in that 700 verses, the amount of stuff that is packed in, okay, you know, we have something called zipped files, you know, in computer science, we have zipped files. When we are not able to send big, big files across, we zip them and then we attach them, they become, so then the receiver has to unzip it. Bhagavad Gita is a zipped file. To all the problems of the world, all the solutions are embedded in this Bhagavad Gita. In the 700 shlokas, okay, he has zipped all the problems that could ever come. Now our problem is, some of us don't have that unzipping software. That is our problem, right? We need that unzip software, WinRAR, right? Generally, that's the software that's used, right? So, Bhagavad Gita, greatest synthesis of human thought. Where did it happen? Where did the Bhagavad Gita happen, geographically? Yeah, what is Kurukshetra? A battlefield. Can you imagine that? The greatest synthesis of human thought happened on a battlefield, not under a tree, not on the banks of a river, not in the inner caves of Himalayas or anywhere like that. It happened right in the middle of a battlefield, right? How ironic, or what a place to choose by the Lord, isn't it? For me, it's fascinating. Even if it did not happen, the person, Bhagavan Vedavyasa, who wrote the story, what a place to keep that as a writer, no? As a storyteller, what a place to give the ultimate message to mankind on the middle of battlefield. Okay? And what happens in the middle of the battlefield? The greatest of human beings, possibly the dream of every, you know, the pinnacle of every person, what we would like to achieve, Arjuna. Right? The most decorated hero of Mahabharata, most powerful, most good-looking, a prince. Everything that we want to be in our life is in the form of Arjuna, who symbolizes human beings. What happens to him? A guy who has been waiting for this battle for years and decades on decades on end. Right? He was, their family was put through possibly the worst humiliation that anybody can face. Okay, the disrobement of his wife in the royal court. Imagine what a situation that is. How the blood must be boiling. And then you are made to go through 13 years of rigorous, absolute, you know, rigorous treatment. And you are preparing for all those 13 years just to teach those fellows a lesson. You come on the verge of battle, and what happens? You don't want to fight. Right? What a situation. Right? The entire first chapter of Bhagavad Gita is called Vishada Yoga. Arjuna Vishada Yoga, which is the disappointedness or the absolute depression of Arjuna, the greatest warrior What happens? He's standing over there. He's looking. He in fact tells Krishna, take my chariot to the center of the battlefield so that I can see whose heads I'm going to cut. Okay, let me see them clearly. So take my chariot to the middle of the battlefield. He sees and suddenly he notices the same grandfather whom he has seen all his life is now standing in front of him. His guru, okay, his all his near and dear ones are standing. And he says, Krishna, I don't think I want to fight. Okay, his bow starts to slip away from his thing. And, you know, the Arjuna Vishada Yoga is one of the longer chapters in Bhagavad Gita. And you know what? Throughout the entire first chapter, no, Krishna is mum. He doesn't, his lips are zipped. He doesn't open his mouth because he is hearing Arjuna give his part of the argument. And believe me, if you listen, if you read the first chapter, no, Arjuna makes a lot of sense. Okay, we are so easily, we say Arjuna was an idiot. Okay, we are also like just like that. If you actually look at his arguments, they make a lot of sense. No, he says, why do I need this kingdom? Let me go back into the forest and become a normal person. I mean, lead a celibate life, lead a sannyasi's life. Right? I don't want fight. I don't want war. I want peace. Okay, and Krishna just listens to him. Tell, whatever you want, you talk. Okay, he doesn't give any solution. Till at the end of the chapter, Arjuna says, why are you not saying anything? Say something, na? Something you tell. Am I right? Am I wrong? Krishna still doesn't say anything. Then he says, you know, actually, Krishna, I'm thinking, I'm confused. I have no idea. I don't know what I'm doing. Can you please tell me? At that moment, Krishna says, now I am your teacher. Sit down and listen to me now. And the remaining 17 chapters is the Bhagavad Gita. Why I like this so much is, it is said, okay, here is an, do you believe that who was more deserved of the Bhagavad Gita? Should the Bhagavad Gita been told to Arjuna or rather to Duryodhana? Duryodhana was the enemy of Pandavas, the brother, right? So did Duryodhana deserve Bhagavad Gita? I mean, shouldn't it have been told to Duryodhana rather than Arjuna? Who needed the Bhagavad Gita more? Duryodhana or Arjuna? I think Duryodhana. Right? The bad guy. The bad guy needs the hammering. Yes, we will, and we will ask him why. Yes. So we will find out that question. What is the meaning of the receptivity? Sir told that Duryodhana did not have receptivity. But that means you mean to say that Krishna was such a poor teacher, is it? That he was not able to teach Duryodhana. His job as a world teacher, Vishwa Guru, if Lord Krishna is the Vishwa Guru, Vishwa Guru should be able to teach anybody. Correct? No. Then what do you mean to say that Duryodhana was a poor student? For poor students, only teachers are there. Smart students don't need teachers. Smart students can learn on their own. Okay, so when this question was kind of put in a particular talk, I was very intrigued. I said, this makes a lot of sense. Was it an avataric blunder that Krishna told the wrong guy the Bhagavad Gita? Krishna should have told Duryodhana. Guess what? Krishna did try to tell the Bhagavad Gita to Duryodhana. When Krishna went as the peace ambassador to Hastinapur before the war, it so happened that as Krishna was walking through the corridors of the palace, he saw Duryodhana walking the other way, okay, and they both met. And Krishna accosts Duryodhana saying, Duryodhana, don't you know that what you are doing is stupid? Don't you know that what you are doing is wrong? And you know what was Duryodhana's answer? It's a fascinating answer. Duryodhana's answer was, hey Krishna, don't give me gyan. Don't tell me what is dharma. His exact listing was, janami dharmam nachame pravritti. Janami adharmam nachame nivritti. Okay, meaning, Krishna, don't talk to me about dharma, okay? I also went to school. I went to the best Ivy League college, Drona School. I also went there. Duryodhana is telling, Janami dharmam, I know what is dharma. Nachame pravritti, I have no inclination towards it. I know what is righteousness, but I don't have any inclination. Pravritti means inclination. I have no inclination. Janami adharmam, I know what is adharma, I know what is misconduct and unrighteousness. Nachame nivritti, I don't feel like leaving it. Duryodhana says this. It's one of the classiest, pieces of sentences in the Mahabharata. The second line of this particular verse is, there is something within me which prompts me to do this and not do this, and I will follow that. Okay, and that is where Krishna also says, okay sir, go ahead. We shall meet you in the battlefield. So Krishna did try to tell Bhagavad Gita. Same thing happened to Arjuna also. In the first chapter of Arjuna, Arjuna is giving all the gyan which is coming out of his heart. Why we should not fight, we should do this, we should do that, I should not do this, I should go back. Right? It's all coming from inside. The difference between Duryodhana and Arjuna is Arjuna surrenders. At the end of it, Arjuna says, I think I'm confused. I don't know what to do. I think this is the way, but I am not sure. Which is when Krishna says, okay, then now that you are not sure and you have asked me, now I will tell you. See, Duryodhana never asked that question. That is another quality of a Sadguru. He will not tell you anything. And how beautiful it is. Actually, he is the most compassionate, isn't it? He knows we are walking on the right, wrong path. And yet, till we surrender, he cannot do anything. He cannot become the writer of our destinies until we give the pen in his hand. That is the difference between Duryodhana and Arjuna. Okay. Believe me, Duryodhana is not the only case. We are all, there is a bit of a Duryodhana in all, each one of us. We know what is good. We know what is right. Nachame pravritti. We don't have inclination towards that. That is why many times we take up a sadhana. We know Bhagavan has told us, chant the name of the Lord, do meditation, etc., etc. We do it for roughly 2.5 days. And then we say that, leave it, yeah. I'll see later on. Nachame pravritti. Because our pravritti is towards the external world. So till we move inwards, we will not get that clarity. And until we get that clarity, we will not be able to walk on that path. Right? So the only way to walk on that path is to allow him to walk us on that path. Once we give our hands in his hands, nothing else we need to do. Then it's only prapatti, which is surrender, pure surrender. In fact, since I've got 2-3 more minutes, I will just share with you a very interesting thought. So the person who I heard this, Janami Dharmam Nachame Pravritti, he went on to explain that, so this was a case of Duryodhana telling 7,000 years ago, right? In 1970s, there was a very famous study in the Harvard University. So Harvard University has been always at the forefront of psychological, psychological studies that they do. And they did something called the Marshmallow Test. Have you heard about the Marshmallow Test? Read it. It's a book. Today it has come out as a book. It's a very fascinating book. It's called the Marshmallow Test. And this test is as follows. What they did was, the test was with 4-year-olds, with little children, even smaller than the children who are seated here. 4-year-olds are made to sit in one room. A professor who is doing the study comes over there. And the child thinks, or he's being told, he or she is being told, that I will ask you some questions. If you answer the questions, you will get a marshmallow. You know what's a marshmallow? It's a beautiful sweet. If you put it in your mouth, it just melts in the mouth. Okay, those of you who don't know marshmallow, we'll make it jalebi or gulab jamun. Okay, so because I love the gulab jamuns in the North Indian canteen here. So gulab jamun will be given. So the child answers some simple questions and the professor says, here is your gulab jamun. So the child is looking at their gulab jamun with, you know, that much fervor, and all the salivatory glands have started working. Now the professor says, if you wait, I have to go out of this room and come back after 10-15 minutes. If you wait for that time, no, you will get two gulab jamuns. You want one gulab jamun or you want two gulab jamun? The child says, I want two gulab jamuns. Okay, then you will have to wait. You should not eat this. Okay? Child says, okay. And the professor goes out. Now, what the child does not know is that that room is fitted with cameras. Okay, and the cameras are looking at what the child is doing. Okay, so the moment the professor goes out, it's on YouTube also. You should check that out. You know, it's called the marshmallow test. It's a very cute video. The child, no, different children, they're showing how they react to that marshmallow in front of them. Some children are looking at that. They're touching it. You know, their salivatory glands are not able to hold it. They're waiting. One child is looking at the door. Means when that professor is going to come. One child turns away its back to that marshmallow. It does not even want to acknowledge the presence of the marshmallow, lest, you know, his instinct may take over and he may. Okay. So about 75% of the children are, with great difficulty, they are able to hold their, you know, their urge to eat. About 25%, no, the moment the professor goes out, they put it into their mouth. Neatly, nicely enjoy it. The professor comes back, and now the professor is asking these 25% children, why did you eat? Oh, and the child, no? Give me my second marshmallow. So the professor is saying, "Arey, the deal was not that. The deal was that you should not eat. If you don't eat, only you'll get second. Why did you eat?" And the child, no, it blinks. It looks at the professor. It doesn't know why it ate. You don't want the second I want the second marshmallow. Then why you ate? I don't know. And this is why I really love the way the scientists analyze. They tracked these children, over the next 20 years. And after 20 years, they figured a fascinating outcome. The 25% children who gave into their urges did not do as well in their life, in their CAT scores, in their O levels, in sports, in whatever they took up. Because they all the time giving to their instincts. The lack of self-control was in all the important decisions of their life, where you needed to exercise self-control, they were not able to exercise, and they gave in. They were not as successful as the other children. And therefore, the marshmallow test goes on to say that self-control is the key to success. So the book's name is Marshmallow Test, the Self-Control, the Key to Success. Okay, our master, so this, the person who was telling us this was telling, Janami Dharmam, that 4-year-old also knows, if I wait, I will get the second marshmallow. But there is some power inside of me which is making me eat and which is not allowing me to think long term. Right? In our spiritual paths also, there will be obstacles. There will be these marshmallows will come, which God himself will come and put, our master will come and put. He will say, you wait for me to come back. Okay, I will give you more than this. Are we ready to wait? Do we have that self-control? Do we have that patience? And that is why Shirdi Baba asked for two things always. He used to ask for two coins. What are the two coins? Shraddha and Saburi. And whenever I used to hear this, no, I used to say, Swami, Shraddha I can give you. Saburi I can't give. Because Shraddha means faith. Okay, Saburi means perseverance. This perseverance is what kills us. Right, we are not ready to persevere because we don't have that patience. Because, you know, in this day and age, when we use WhatsApp, if the second tick does not come, our heart goes up and down. Correct? That one tick means sent, the second tick means delivered. That we don't even have that much self-control or patience to wait for the second tick. Where are we going to wait for the second tick which God is ready to give us? Right? So that is the two coins that Swami is asking of us. He wants only those 2 rupees for which he is going to give us everything that we need in our life. Thank you for this opportunity, Sai Ram.
Says God is peace.